And tonight on Coast to Coast, back by popular demand, our reporter Linda Moulton Howe joins us with some incredible stories, and we'll get right into them in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie, Linda Moulton Howe, Emmy Award-winning television producer, investigative reporter, author. She's got a number of stories for us that you are going to just dive into with her. And then the last hour of the program tonight, Conversations with Linda, will take your phone calls, questions, or maybe you're a whistleblower and you've got a story idea or a tip for Linda as well. Linda, welcome back. I got so many emails on your non-appearance last month.
Well, thank you very much. My daughter is in the very end of her first pregnancy, and it was one of those where almost like a miracle of being able to spend time with her after the MUFON conference in July, because this is really an extraordinary family event, and the baby, all is going well, and all should be now known in October when she's born. So this is a first in my life and a first in my daughter's life.
Granny Linda, here she comes.
That's right.
Right?
And Mom, I might say. And it is, I used to look at it from a distance of people thinking about, well, maybe that's never going to happen. And now it is, and it's thrilling. And I got to experience something that is part of the modern medical world now. Went with her to get a 3D ultrasound, and we were able to see this baby, the face, the fingers, everything, as
it
if you were looking at a baby. It was incredible.
It is so exciting. We just had a party for my three-year-old granddaughter, Charlie. Her name's Charlotte, and just absolutely, you know, you can't describe it, Linda. You really can't.
It's life going on forward, which is a big part of some of what I'm going to be talking about from the beginning to the end tonight, starting with the sadness of the die-off of the Sea Stars.
Yeah, explain that. Go ahead.
If you and the Coast audience will go to my news website, earthfiles.com, and click on that top headline, Sea Stars Continue to Die by the Millions from Alaska to California, Is It a Virus?, you will see everything in two photographs. One, the luxurious look of healthy sea stars on a rock, and only 20 days later, it's all gone. It's all dead. And that has been happening for an entire year, from Alaska and to Vancouver and down to San Diego. And the whole summer has been warmer than usual. And at the same time, these millions of sea stars in at least a dozen different species of them have been rotting away in this mysterious wasting disease that causes arms to drop off, and then the bodies literally rot and dissolve away. Cornell University DNA research is said to be leading up to publication that the cause is a virus, but nothing has been printed yet. Many scientists are linking the warming waters and the warming climate change to a general increase everywhere in all kinds of microbes that cause disease, from something like maybe the disintegration of these sea stars. And it's happening in corals and so much Earth life. And by October 2013, the Seattle Aquarium in Puget Sound, the Vancouver Aquarium, and the California Science Center in Santa Cruz told scientists there that 100% of their sea stars were melting away. And that led to the water in those aquariums was coming from the ocean. So that was the common denominator to the wild and the aquariums. One of the divers in Howe Sound, Indian Arm, and Puget Sound is videographer and naturalist Neil McDaniel. He's 65 and a resident of Vancouver, Canada. He has been diving now for nearly half a century and is shocked by the sea star devastation that he continues to see with his own eyes ongoing through 2014 right to this day in August. Here now from Vancouver is diving videographer Neil McDaniel.
The situation in British Columbia is ongoing. I mean, the sea star wasting disease has not decreased or diminished in any way. In fact, animals continue to die, and now we know that there are up to a dozen or more different species besides the sunflower stars, which were the big sea stars that we first saw dying in Howe Sound close to Vancouver.
And I remember when we talked in December 2013, a few months ago, that the Cornell DNA people thought that they were going to be able to find whatever the problem was through DNA sequencing and finding some sort of microbe. But it's my understanding, as we talk in mid-August 2014, that there still is not an identification of what is wrong.
Well, I think they know what's wrong now, but they haven't published it yet. My understanding is that Ian Houston at the University of Cornell, he's isolated what this thing is, that they're going to come out and say it is a virus. But what does that mean? There's nothing really we can do about it. I mean, the virus seems to be very aggressive. It's virulent. It's striking many different species of sea stars. It's kind of interesting that other types of echinoderms, which are animals related to sea stars, such as sea urchins, sea cucumbers, crinoids, those kinds of animals, have not been affected that I've seen by this virus. It's restricted to the sea stars at this point.
This is causing arms to fall off and
yes,
tissue.
This is a deadly virus. This virus kills these animals. It's amazing how quickly it kills them as well. That's what struck me, was the speed at which these animals would die once they became infected. Let me just describe what we first saw and what we're still seeing now with regard to the sea stars. For example, you'd be on a dive, you're going along, and you see a sea star. Let's say it's a sunflower star, and you look at it carefully and you realize the animal doesn't look right. It looks deflated, and in more advanced stages of the disease, the arms of the sea star actually begin to fall off. And then even more advanced, you'll see these ulcerated holes in the body wall of the sea star, and it looks to the average person like the animal's rotting, and that is exactly what's happening to it. Eventually, the animal will die, and then bacteria move in, and they very quickly consume the balance of the organic material. Within a few weeks, all you're left with is a pile of small calcareous fragments that made up the skeleton of the sea star. So it's a disease which progresses very rapidly. It is widespread in terms that it affects many different species of sea stars. It's widespread geographically in the sense that it is found right from Alaskan waters right down to Southern California. The area that I know best is southern British Columbia, where I dive a lot. You know, that's the area that I've been looking at and keeping an eye on. In Washington State, like Puget Sound, I get regular reports from a friend of mine who dives a lot in Puget Sound, and the situation in Puget Sound looks really grim. It's really bad there. Several different species, they're just dying like flies. They're dropping dead, hundreds of them every day. And it's not an exaggeration to say that since this disease first became widely known back in September of 2013, it's not an exaggeration to say that millions of sea stars have died on the coast of North America. The other thing was, too, that back in September of 2013, in Howe Sound, we had unusually large numbers of sunflower stars. There were absolutely thousands and thousands of them on some of the reefs. It was one of those situations where you looked at it and thought, well, there's way too many of them. What's going on here? Why are there so many? And then population collapsed. And within a month or so, all of those sea stars were gone, just totally erased from those reefs.
Today, as we speak in August of 2014, when you are diving, are you seeing vast areas completely empty of sea stars?
Well, I'll give you one example. A place called the Defense Islands in Upper Howe Sound. In September of 2013, there were huge numbers of very large sunflower stars. Some of them were up to the size of a garbage can lid, some 3 feet across, and there were thousands of them. Now, the virus, or whatever the disease is, struck in that time, and within a month, most of those animals were gone. Since then, I've dived that site several times. All of the big sunflower stars are gone, but there are some small ones that have reappeared. So we see small sunflower stars of the order of perhaps 2 inches, 3 inches, maybe 4 inches across. They're fairly abundant. They seem to be active and healthy. But what will happen to them in a few months as they get older? I'm not really sure whether these animals are resistant or more resistant to the virus, or whether they're also going to die as they get older.
What happens in the food chain when those big sea stars are gone?
Well, when you take a major predator like a big sunflower star out of the picture, it causes a whole cascade of effects to the ecology of a reef. Now, these animals, when you have huge numbers of them, like we saw at the Defense Islands, they consume great quantities of mussels, barnacles, other kinds of creatures. They're pretty indiscriminate in the kinds of things that they eat. So if you remove them from the picture, obviously the mussels and barnacles are going to have fewer predation on them. And other animals such as green urchins, I've seen a huge increase in the number of green urchins in some of these areas. That could be a problem because green urchins graze on seaweeds. If we get a proliferation of green urchins, we may have less abundance of seaweeds in these areas. We can cross our fingers and hope it goes away. And that's the other thing. At this point, to me, it seems like this virus, maybe it's here to stay for a while. It may be years before this virus works its way through the system and before the newer sea stars develop some sort of immunity to it.
My heavens, what would the consequence be if this virus continued to wipe them out for years?
The consequences could literally change the very nature of our shorelines.
The huge die-off of sea stars from Alaska to San Diego, California, has provoked the hypothesis that if the culprit is a virus or bacteria, it is taking hold of the sea stars in this devastating way because the waters are so much warmer. As atmospheric CO2 has steadily increased, the Earth's oceans have been absorbing a lot of the CO2. Today, those surface waters are 30% more acidic than a century ago. More acid means a lower pH that destroys seashells. Calcium carbonate shells of many marine creatures cannot grow in more acidic waters, and the animals die. More acidic oceans could also deteriorate the protective outer layers of sea stars. Like dominoes falling, that could throw off the salt and water chemistry of sea stars and weaken their immunity so that the millions of viruses and bacteria that naturally live in seawater can take over weakened creatures. I called marine biologist Chris Langdon, Ph.D., at the Rosenstiel School of Marine and Atmospheric Science in the Department of Marine Biology and Ecology at the University of Miami. His main research is the decline in diseases of corals in the face of warming waters and other assaults of climate change. I asked Professor Langdon if he thought the sudden lethal attack of microbes on sea stars could be directly linked to warming waters.
Yeah, these pathogens can be normally present, and then you add the temperature, which stresses the organism. You know, it's spending more energy to deal with the thermal stress, and suddenly its ability to resist infection goes down dramatically.
Right, and Ian Hewson at Cornell, he is a DNA genome specialist. He's been trying to get to the bottom of what is happening to the sea stars, and he said that there is roughly 10 million viruses per milliliter of seawater. There's a million bacteria per milliliter of seawater.
Yeah.
And this is the same seawater that floats through the veins of the sea stars.
Yeah, they're always present. And in fact, diseases with the corals that wipe them out, there's certain kinds of E. coli, which is a normal part of our gut, become extremely pathogenic. So it's possible that, yes, these things are here all the time, but because something has reduced the fitness of the organism, suddenly this becomes a danger to it rather than a help.
What is your understanding of the consequences of warming waters, air and land, and viruses and bacteria being able to infect life more on this planet?
It might be as simple as that the growth rate of these organisms is an exponential function of temperature. So a single degree increase in temperature can cause dramatic increases in the rate at which these pathogens can grow. Our immune systems have evolved ways to keep them suppressed. We never eliminate them entirely. We're just killing them slightly faster than they're able to grow currently. But if conditions warm and they're able to grow more quickly and our immune systems are unable to keep up, and plants and animals and all the different immune systems, then I can see that there could be this shifting balance in favor of outbreaks of disease organisms.
So Earth life would have immune systems that were geared to a cooler planet, and if it's warming more rapidly, then the immune system is not even having the time to catch up to the increase in viruses and bacteria.
Right. And potentially, if we're not wiped out, we'll catch up again. But this is constant battle. Just like how different bacteria become immune to our antibiotics all the time, we have to keep coming up with new ones.
And if it is a virus on the west coast of North America that is wiping out the sea stars by the millions, it may be that the link to this suddenly happening is that it is a virus that was suppressed before by cooler temperatures and it now is let loose by warmer temperatures.
Correct. That's how I would look at it.
And George, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, reports that this June 2014 was the warmest June on record with the highest average land and ocean temperatures. And one of the reasons that scientists are worried about what's happening with the sea stars is that they're known as what are called keystone species. Their survival is very important to the whole environment around them. They play this really key role of keeping of animals above and animals below healthy. And right now, millions have died in this past year. And because they are considered a keystone predator and that they usually are eating things like mussels and other sea creatures that keeps them in balance in the population, the concern is that we are going to be seeing a wholesale change in what now starts filling in Puget Sound and up and down the coast, if the sea stars are really decimated to the fact that they're not coming back, at least not for a while. There's been a little ray of hope that in several places along the coast where scientists are looking, they have been finding little baby sea stars. But what they don't know is this. The little baby sea stars may start growing and get to a certain adult stage, just like all the others, the millions that have died off, and then succumb to whatever this is. And if Cornell is right, and it is a virus, they should be publishing in another month or two, we hope, so that we could learn more about this. And it is one of those situations where just this past week, in Florida, for example, Florida Governor Rick Scott, he met with five scientists who asked him to meet with them because they are extremely concerned about Florida's future. They are measuring water rises that are now beginning to go past what the IPCC used to say might be the issue here at the end of the century, maybe 1 to 3 feet of sea rise. Now they're concerned it might be double that. And what happens to Florida's barrier islands all the way to Lake Okeechobee? They're expecting that it will go underwater. And that is now one of the other, you'll say, the pieces in this wall that we're beginning to see being built by climate warming, that not only are the ocean creatures threatened, land creatures are threatened, but humans are now facing the fact that something like the state of Florida, in another maybe 20, 30, 50 years, that all that water will be up to Lake Okeechobee. And then what do we do?
Are we facing a sixth mass extinction? We'll talk about that with Linda when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Linda Moulton Howe with us. We've got some real incredible stories for you that Linda has been working on. And Linda, somewhat related, you're continuing this bizarre story, but are we facing another mass extinction?
We are in the sixth mass extinction, and I'm not kidding. It was only a week ago on August 20th that the Institute for Biological Diversity reported this, quote, Our planet is now in the midst of its sixth mass extinction of plants and animals in the past half billion years. Scientists estimate we're now losing dozens of species to extinction every day. It could be a scary future indeed, with as many as 30% to 50% of all species possibly heading toward extinction by mid-century, this century, the 21st century. One estimate of the present rate of extinction could be up to 140,000 species gone each year. The cause? Human expansion around the planet into lands once abundant with diverse Earth life and using cars and other machines that emit lots of greenhouse gases. According to air bubbles trapped in Antarctic and Greenland ice, for nearly a million years, Earth's carbon dioxide levels only varied between 180 and 300 parts per million right up to the beginning of the human industrial revolution in the 1800s. Only 200 years later, by July 2014, CO2 has now risen to 399 parts per million and is expected to be over 600 parts per million by 2050. That's not very long from now. Humans are now responsible for adding about 35 billion tons of CO2 per year to the Earth environment. 30 to 40% of that CO2 is absorbed by the surface waters of the world's oceans and seas. And all that CO2 keeps lowering the water pH, causing increasing acidity. And you can see graphs, fascinating graphs, of pH and CO2 relationships at my news website, earthfiles.com, by clicking on this report's hot link at the top of the headline page. In the past decade, what we have had have been a whole series of die-offs now, and we just talked about sea stars. And my interview continues with marine biologist Chris Langdon, Ph.D., at the Rosenstiel School of Marine and Atmospheric Science in the Department of Marine Biology and Ecology at the University of Miami. I asked Professor Langdon what the worst case for the future might be and if the current sixth mass extinction could be directly caused by a rapidly warming Earth. Here now is Professor Langdon from Miami.
The worst case is the rapid loss of species. But what's really unusual about this extinction event is that the climate is changing anywhere between 10 and 100 times faster than in even the previous extinction events.
Just to make sure that I understand, you are saying that right now the changes due to climate on planet Earth are now 10 right. to 100 times faster than they occurred 65 million years ago when an asteroid right. crashed and made the Chicxulub crater in the Gulf.
Right. Mm-hmm. We have almost a million-year record of the CO2 concentration in the atmosphere locked up in these bubbles in the ice caps on Greenland and Antarctica. It allows us to reconstruct almost on a yearly basis, how the CO2 concentration in the atmosphere has varied over time. So that's how we can say that the CO2 concentration in the atmosphere today is increasing anywhere between 10 and 100 times faster than when the climate went into and out of these interglacial periods. There's been eight cycles over the last 800,000 years. It has everything to do with the rate of change. If you add the CO2 to the Earth system slowly, then there's natural buffering mechanisms. So if the CO2 in the atmosphere gets to 800, if you add it slowly, the pH of the ocean does not go anywhere near as low as when you add it more quickly. The reason is if you add it quickly, as we are today, then it only has time to dissolve into the upper layer of the ocean. So you're putting the same amount of CO2 into a thinner layer of the ocean. So the same amount of CO2 into a smaller volume results in a bigger decrease in pH.
And what is contributing the most now to the 10 to 100 times faster is human civilization
yes.
and CO2 releases and methane.
Right.
That raises this issue How much do you think that ocean species are going to change the rest of this century if warming water is going to happen, and that we are already seeing there are fish that used to be further south are going north, that now we have this huge problem with sea stars, that we are in the process of not only the sixth mass extinction, but a huge change and migration of animals out of warmer water to cool, and what will happen to the way the planet looks?
Right. So we have climate-driven migrations of species, but for some species, that's not an option, and corals are an example of that. As the water is warm, they will try to move northward, but there's other hard limits, and part of that has to do with light. As you go to higher latitudes, there's a bigger seasonal difference in the amount of sunlight that you receive over the annual cycle. And corals, in addition to requiring clear, warm water, have very high light requirements. So as soon as you go 5 or more degrees further north, during the winter, the days will be too short and the skies during the winter are too overcast for them to have enough light to survive the winter months.
What happens if all of the corals in the oceans die?
It's called the slippery slope to slime. We start with beautiful, hard, rocky reefs, and what we're concerned about is them being replaced by jellyfish and algae and other scum up bacteria and slimy mucusy things, just like cockroaches could survive a nuclear holocaust. These are the tough guys that can survive. The climate's going to start changing so rapidly that it's going to be very difficult for humans to adjust. We're already seeing these droughts on the West Coast and how that's going to affect agriculture dramatically.
The National Center for Atmospheric Research, they are reporting that it is true that the downpours and the floods are increasing because as the air warms, it can absorb more water, and that water has to come out of the atmosphere, and that there is an increasing syndrome of heavier downpours and floods.
Yeah, in certain areas, the weather and the climate is just going to get weird. It's going to get wetter in some areas, and then some areas they're going to get drier. And everything we've known and think we know and, you know, use to decide when and where we're going to plant our crops could change because climate's going to get different. So it's going to be very much more difficult to do that if certain areas are too wet to plant crops when they want to plant them. And then other areas are going through droughts that last 10 or 20 years. So it's going to become a real food security issue at some point. And that's why I'm saying we can't afford not to solve this problem.
Mm-hmm.
The sooner we tackle it, the less expensive it will be, because you can do it over a longer time. You can do things more gradually. It would be smart to get on board and start to tackle these problems sooner rather than later. Eventually, the water's going to get hot enough, and just like the frog in the pot, you either die or get smart.
What do you say to the critics who argue that there is no global warming, that there is no global climate change toward warming, that in fact we could be moving into an ice age?
Okay, that's a great question. If you look back over the last 600,000 years, there's been an interglacier cycle about every 100,000 years. And based on that, the current interglacial that we're in should be coming to an end, and we should, based on that history and the natural cycle of the Earth, be heading into another glacial period. So back in the 60s, you can look at scientific papers, and that's exactly what they were predicting. So I would say that the fact that we're not, the climate is very obviously warming, is a demonstration that humans are having a bigger impact on climate than these natural cycles, and that we're now the dominant factor in climate. So I think it's undeniable that climate's warming, and it's due to humans, that we're acting against the normal climatic cycle that would be sending us into a cooler period.
In the month of August, I have found articles all related to the sixth mass extinction on this planet, and I'm wondering what goes through your marine biology mind as you continue to see the media with headlines that we're on a planet now where humans are causing the sixth mass extinction.
Yeah, it's mixed feelings. In one sense, people are finally hearing what I've been seeing for a while, so that gives me some hope. But what I find is that people go from denial that there's a problem, you know, climate change isn't real, and then instead of a middle ground of, hey, it's real, let's do something about it, they immediately flip-flop to defeatism. Everything's going to die. Why bother trying to do anything? And they never stop in between where we're problem solvers. And that's where we need to be. And thinking that everything's going to be too expensive. We should be thinking that we can't afford not to be doing it. You know, if this was our health, you know, you don't need perfect certainty that certain behavior is giving you a 50% greater chance of heart attack, right? Most of us, that's enough certainty right there to change our behavior. And yet for climate change, people seem to want 99.99% certainty before they think it's worth doing anything. And that's just stupid. You know, we invested $800 billion in TARP to fix a problem with our economy. And we did that with hardly a ripple. And yet a fraction of that would be enough to substantially deal with climate warming. And yet we think we can't afford to do it. And yet there's this crystal clear example where, you know, you could put almost $1 trillion into a problem in just a couple of years and didn't ruin us.
And that was for banks. And we're talking about the entire world and Earth life being saved by some sort of effort to control emissions.
Exactly.
In terms of analyzing the acidity in oceans and seawaters on the Earth now in 2014 and comparing it to the past, what has been the increase in acidity starting from when to when?
So one baseline is the start of the Industrial Revolution, sometime in the early 1800s. The pH of the surface ocean would have been about 8.2. And today, it's 8.05. So it's about 0.15 of a pH unit lower in the last 200, 250 years. So that doesn't sound like a big number, but pH is measured on a logarithmic scale. So just like the Richter scale for earthquakes, where each number is a factor of 10 increase, each unit of pH change from pH 8 to pH 7, that's a tenfold increase in acidity.
Wow.
So 0.15 is a 30% increase in the acidity of the ocean. And by the end of this century, if the pH gets to 7.8, which is conservatively what we're predicting, if the CO2 concentration gets up to about 900, which it certainly looks like it will, that would be a 250% increase in acidity. So a 2.5-fold increase in acidity, and that's plenty big enough to upset the biology of lots of organisms.
And what we don't know is what will replace all of these species that are dying out.
Right. Something will replace it, but it's very unlikely it's going to be something desirable. Like krill are being replaced by jellyfish called salps. And the organisms that, you know, the whales and stuff that love to feed on krill don't do so well trying to feed on jellyfish.
Corals being replaced by seaweed and algae.
Yeah, right. That kind of ecosystem is not going to support the beautiful populations of colored fish. You know, it's going to be slimy bacteria and who knows what else.
And that is the slide into slime.
The slippery slope to slime and cockroaches.
Ah, the slippery slope to slime, Linda.
I know. And in the past, I have interviewed scientists who are even worried about the Amazon rainforest over the next 90 years becoming more desertified. And so we're talking about a planet that is so changed in just the end of this century. And recently, scientists have reported about a new number coming from Greenland's ice sheet, which they are trying to track very carefully, because depending upon how much is melting from that will affect exactly how much sea level rise we should be looking for, that plus the Antarctic and what's coming off of glaciers all over the planet. And even though they've known that Greenland's ice sheet has been thinning for decades, this is the first time that they have found in what they call the northeast region that used to be stable for 25 years. They just kept counting on it being stable. But since 2003 to this day, the northeast ice has lost, the loss of the ice has nearly tripled in a decade. And one of the professors from Ohio State University, Michael Bevis, said, "We are seeing an acceleration of ice loss. There's more ice leaving than snow arriving now in the northeast region of Greenland." And this decline in Greenland's ice sheet, it's the second in size of ice on the planet next to Antarctica. This particular sheet covers 80% of Greenland's surface, and it has been a major contributor to global sea level rise. They know that. And so now the question is, what happens if this acceleration of something like the northeast region of Greenland continues to accelerate like it has the last decade? And the this Professor Beavis concluded, quote, "It has the potential of significantly changing the total mass balance of the Greenland ice sheet in the near future." So we are living at a time where that number, think about that, 140,000 species of Earth life on this planet can be dying out every single year, gone, and that the ice melt is accelerating, the acidity is increasing in the oceans, the blanket is getting thicker, and we are on what appears to be a terrible course if we don't try to do something to help control in a slower way. I think that's one of the things I hope everybody hears. It's the rapidity with which this planet has been warming over the last 200 years that is unlike anything in any of the ice records. It is the rapidity. The animals, the plants don't have a chance to move. The whole issue of what's happening at the surface waters of the ocean, because it is so rapid and the surface waters are becoming so acidic so fast, that's why they estimated over a billion, it's a staggering, a billion snails died in the Northwest just in the last two, three, 4 years. So from sea stars to snails, we're in the sixth mass extinction. We are equivalent to that asteroid that slammed into the Gulf of Mexico 65 million years ago. We are humans. We are intelligent. We have done stuff that has brought us to this point. It's time that we now said that we can apply to what's happening and slow down global warming like we at least put $700 to $800 billion into TARP.
We may be the asteroid, Linda.
That's right. Yeah, I hope not.
So you're working on some hybrid stories for us next hour.
That's right. This is really amazing.
We will look into that when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM.